unite to create an unforgettable cultural experience. Dive into a multitude of workshops from Indian rhythm on Western drums to playing raga music on the guitar. For more information and tickets, visit festivaloftabla.com and kpfk.org.
This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My wonderful co-host and friend Jim Lafferty is still overseas, living the good life, traveling abroad for the summer, but he'll be back in just a few weeks. In the meantime, we've got another great show lined up. In our first half hour, we'll welcome back to the show our good friend Vincent DiStefano from the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee, a group which is in a very celebratory mood right now. Vincent will share the backstory on some of the negotiations that led to Julian's hard-fought release from prison just 2 weeks ago, and of course, the many, many thousands of people whose voices helped secure that result. Then in our second half hour, we'll meet members of UE Local 108 who are fighting to save not only their own union jobs, but also to prevent even more serious backlogs in immigration processing. Their employer, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, or USCIS, intends to shutter its last remaining Southern California service center and relocate it to Texas, where they can hire all non-union staff. So please stay tuned for that. Okay, let's jump right into our first segment. We've got some good news, which is I wish we could say more of on the Lawyers Guild Show, but we definitely want to take time to celebrate successes. For well over a decade, the Lawyers Guild Show has followed the journey of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, whose publishing of classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes made him public enemy number one among successive U.S. government administrations. And during these past 4 years, while he's been locked away in UK's Belmarsh high-security prison, we've been regularly featuring stories from journalists and human rights advocates who have been sounding the alarm, not only to end the politically motivated prosecution of Julian as an individual journalist, but also to protect freedom of the press on a larger and global scale. For Julian, even earlier this year, his fate seemed uncertain. He was in ill physical health, and although the UK court gave him permission to file yet another appeal against extradition to the US, that would still mean he'd be locked away in Belmarsh, over 10,000 miles away from home. And of course, there was a chance he could lose the appeal, and then he'd be sent to the US for trial in possible prison. But as this situation became more dire, Assange's supporters grew louder. Calls from journalists, activists, and politicians resounded from around the world. And then, just like that, it seemed to be, on June 25th, I woke up and there was a headline, Julian Assange is free. Indeed, today he is safe at home in Australia, recuperating with his family. So just how did all of this come about? What high-stakes negotiations and lobbying and pressure were taking place behind the scenes to clinch Assange's freedom? To talk through these and other questions, I'm so happy to introduce our guest, Vincent DiStefano, the National Organizing Director of the U.S. Assange Defense Committee. Vinny is a lifelong social justice activist and serves on the ACLU of Southern California Board of Directors. He was also recognized as the Urgent Action Letter Writer of the Year by Amnesty International, and that is a great award to receive. Vincent DiStefano, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Well, Maria, thank you very much. One tiny correction. I am no longer a board member of the ACLU. I'm still an active member, but unfortunately, they've consolidated the board down, and I didn't make the cut. Hey, but I still work for the ACLU and still love the ACLU and continue to participate.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm a big fan of simplifying life because, we all have so much on our plate, and it is a lot. And there's a lot of work out there that needs to be done. So we have to be careful about not spreading ourselves too thin. So it's all good.
It's all good.
Yes. And I wanted to start out by talking about the plea deal, first of all, because people may have seen the headlines, but what exactly did Julian plea to? What were the charges? And then what exactly were the terms?
Well, that's an excellent question, Maria. Julian's plea agreement required him to plead guilty to one and only one of the 17 conspiracy charges against him under the Espionage Act. And in his pleading, when he pleaded to this one case of accepting it, being in a conspiracy to accept classified documents from a whistleblower, he stated to the judge in the Marianas Islands, more about that in a moment, that he pled guilty to this charge, recognizing that when he committed this crime, he did not think it was a crime, and that this espionage stands in direct contradiction to the First Amendment. Now, in accepting his plea, he'll be not subjected to any further prosecution for any of the other charges related to the WikiLeaks exposures. That means the hacking charge and the other 16 charges that were brought against him are dead, null and void. The plea deal does not contain a gag order either, which will allow him to discuss his case in public on any platform he chooses. And the plea deal also allowed Julian to avoid travel to the continental United States, where he still believes, and we still believe, he would be in great peril from the U.S. government. When he was released on bail from Belmarsh Prison on June 24th, 4 a.m. in the morning here, West Coast time, I was up watching this on the internets. He flew on a charter flight to a courthouse in the U.S. territory in the Pacific Ocean, known as the Northern Marianas Islands, Saipan, to be exact. For those of you who are fans of World War II, you remember Saipan. As I mentioned, part of this deal was that Julian did not have to appear in the continental United States. The Marianas are actually part of the U.S. legal system, but very far from the Eastern District Court of Virginia, where his case would have been heard, and much closer in proximity to Australia, where he ultimately ended up. Now, those were some of the reasons for Julian choosing this site as part of the plea deal to have his case heard. Now, it is a side note. None of the countries involved, England, the U.S., or Australia, provided a flight from England to Saipan for Julian, and he was barred from using a commercial flight. Therefore, the expense of the private jet was £250,000, which he is responsible for. Now, that in U.S. dollars is about $700,000. Now, the good news is a GoFundMe page has pretty much covered the cost of that. Now, the plea agreement placed some constraints on Julian. They're important to note. He can no longer do FOIA requests on himself. My good friend John Kiriakou suffered the same thing when he pleaded guilty, not to the Espionage Act, but to another act. Now, this is actually really not much of anything, because Stella Assange and the entire defense network is happy to add that my good friend, noted scholar Chip Gibbons from Defending Rights and Dissent, has already begun multiple FOIA requests on Julian, and that means that the agreement is particularly moot. As a matter of fact, Stella urged everyone to do their own FOIA request as citizens or as journalists, and Assange Defense will be creating a website where everything that is revealed will be cataloged and made accessible to the public, much like WikiLeaks did before. Now, Julian also relinquished his right to discovery. Now, that would have been important had he been allowed to appeal. But one of the other things that he gave up was his right to appeal his guilty plea. Now, why might he have wished to do that? Julian was charged with the Espionage Act, and our efforts now going forward, and Stella called this out, is to repeal or severely alter the Espionage Act. Now, if it were repealed in a perfect world, Julian would no longer be allowed to appeal his plea deal. He wouldn't be able to go to court again. That's part of the deal. Now, he also agreed to return to the U.S. or destroy any unpublished information that WikiLeaks possesses. Now, more important is this information is over 10 years old and has been published elsewhere on many, many platforms, including CryptoMe, where everything was reported in an unredacted fashion. And Daniel Ellsberg, shortly before he died, he requested from Julian everything that WikiLeaks possessed so he could offer himself up as a sacrificial lamb to the U.S. government and say, if you're going to charge Julian, you need to charge me.
Whoa.
This is a perfect example of selective prosecution, which this case exemplifies, because they did not prosecute John Wilson, who published everything Julian did before he did in an unredacted fashion, and, of course, Daniel Ellsberg. Now, of greater importance to our audience, in the words of Bruce Afran, a U.S. constitutional lawyer, this plea is not a precedent. And for those of you who are, you know, legally adept, a precedent is a legal ideal that is set in a court of law. Precedents consist of decisions interpreting a matter of law by an appeals court that will govern future cases on the same legal principle. In contrast, a plea deal, which Julian took advantage of, is merely a factual agreement by a given defendant that they did a certain act, but does not bind future defendants in similar cases. Now, for example, since Julian chose to drop his First Amendment defense and plead guilty, this does not mean that a similar defendant in the future does not have a First Amendment defense in an espionage case. No appeals court has decided such issues, and Julian's plea does not bind future courts or future parties, nor will ever be considered in any other defense case. This is a doctrine that a person bound by a factual decision, including a plea, only if they participate in the case, and that means no future defendants is going to be hamstrung by this. Now, I would note that regardless of that, there cannot be denied that a precedent was set. And the precedent was that Julian spent 7 years of asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy and then more than 5 years under the harshest condition in Belmarsh prison, being convicted of nothing at a time when his only crime was that of honest journalism. Now, that sends a very clear message to journalists and whistleblowers. What's in store for you should you go against the imperial might of the U.S. intelligence service? But from a legal standpoint, this was a great appeal.
Right. And tell us also about what fate Julian Assange potentially avoided by accepting it.
Well, this is an incredible question, Maria. It's true that Julian had a very good chance, I mean, an almost certainty, that the British magistrates on July 10th would have found in his favor. Therefore, in a perfect world, it would have been better for journalism to continue to reject the plea deal, which I might add Julian wished to do. He had to be forced to take this plea deal by his family and trust in a judicial victory. That's because it could have settled this matter in a way that would have upheld the protections for press freedom enshrined in our First Amendment that were directly contradicted by the use of the Espionage Act, as Julian pointed out in his sentencing. This is something that Daniel Ellsberg felt was a missed opportunity in his case, because his case was settled by legal malfeasance and not going to court to settle the matter once and for all. This would have been walking free, having made zero concessions, and that would have been a preferable outcome. Very good for journalism, unfortunately very bad for Julian. There's no doubt that although the appeal would have been accepted, the U.S. would have appealed the High Court's rejection on the request for extradition. Julian would have had to spend many more years in Belmarsh while the appeals and counterappeals dragged on and on and on, as the case has done so far. More importantly, even if Julian was finally set free from this extradition, he would only be free from the extradition to the United States. He would not be free of the charges against him, because the British court could not decide those charges. Only the U.S. District Court in Eastern Virginia could. Thus, with 18 indictments still hanging over his head, Julian would be continually exposed to new requests for extradition, thus more precautionary detention in jail by the Department of Justice for the rest of his life. The only way to be completely free with the entanglements was to lay the 18 indictments to rest, accepting one and getting the others withdrawn, which is exactly what he did. Good for journalism, and now good for Julian as well. Now, as I said, I have it on good authority that Julian did not want to take this deal, but was only encouraged to do so by his family because they wanted him back in their arms again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm imagining his lawyers, too, because I would be if I were his lawyer, I would be saying, this is an amazing deal. Take it now and go home. Yeah. So I agree. So speaking of that, the people around him, how have his family been coping with all this? And of course, how are they feeling now?
Well, you know, it's like Dickens said, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. And I have to tell you, I have the great pleasure of knowing Stella and even better, knowing John and Gabriel Shipton, his brother and father, personally. And my opinion is that their heroism was only outdone by their tenacity and unbending courage. And to highlight this, when I was in London to cover the case for Assange defense, I spent some time with Stella in a little tiny cramped staging area where speakers at the Royal Court of Justice would get up to have their say in front of the crowd. And I can tell you that simply looking at Stella, you could tell she was devastated and in incredible pain. It broke my heart to look at her because I've been happily married for 37 years, and I can only imagine what it would be like having my wife in prison under conditions like Julian was. So my heart broke for her. However, when she stepped up to speak to the crowd in front of the Royal Courts of Justice, every scintilla of that pain and discouragement melted away as she spoke forcefully and with unflinching passion that moved the crowd assembled and me.
Wow.
I got to tell you, she's one of the strongest people it has ever been the pleasure of mine to meet. Wow. And that's why I'm happy to say that Julian, Stella, Max, and Gabriel, their two children, and simply being a family after this long ordeal. They are actually incommunicado while Julian and his family heal, and that will take quite a while. I have it on good authority to end on a very happy note that Julian, who has not felt the sun on his skin for the 12 years that this was in place, not only feels the sun in his skin, but he swims in the ocean every single day.
Wow. Well, that is amazing. Well, let's go back to, I do like that whole image of just being so appreciative of feeling the sun and the ocean and the elements and nature. Jeez. So let's talk about the backstory a little bit. Obviously, I'm sure some was attorney-client privilege, but you were also in on a lot, you know, with the Assange Defense Committee. So how was this deal negotiated? There must have been so many moving parts. And of course, you mentioned the Mariana Islands. How the heck did it end up out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? But more, I'm really interested in just like the attorneys and the pressure on different, you know, the president of Australia or prime minister, you know, and then, of course, the U.S. So, sorry, I'm throwing a lot out. Let's start one by one. Just tell us a little backstory about the plea deal and how it ended up in, well, you already talked about the middle of the ocean. So let's talk about the lawyers.
Okay, the plea deal was actually many years in the making. If you remember, it was more than 2 years ago that U.S. Ambassador to Australia, Carolyn Kennedy, floated the idea of the possibility of a plea deal. However, nothing came of it. Now, in my opinion, that was just a U.S. stalling tactic because the compliant British courts were giving the U.S. prosecutors everything they wanted. However, in May of this year, with two different sitting judges, it looked like Julian would be prevailing. As a matter of fact, in his extradition, that is when the negotiations began in earnest. Oh. An element of this backstory highlights why the appeal moves forward so quickly after this long legal battle. On April 4th, I believe it's April 4th, a U.S. attorney working on the case sent a secret memo to the Department of Justice clearly stating that the U.S. was about to lose this case.
Whoa.
Yes, that is the impetus for this deal. His memo was based on the statement on the inability of the prosecution to provide Julian First Amendment protection. When questioned on this, Gordon Cromberg in the court in the hearing back in May could not state unequivocally that he would be provided First Amendment protection. As a matter of fact, exactly the opposite. He and his co-counsel actually had said outside the courtroom that not only did they not believe that non-U.S. citizens were entitled to First Amendment protection, these two individuals chillingly said, Nobody, not even U.S. citizens, are entitled to that First Amendment protection. And the British courts, in their extradition treaty, have to adhere to what is the standard in Britain and the European Court of Human Rights. And that means he needed to be provided that First Amendment protection. Now, that single fact doomed the extradition completely. The truly sad thing here is that this could have been addressed more than 4 years ago by Vanessa Barrister, because it was presented the same evidence. And she, in a rather Kafkaesque fashion, refused to acknowledge it. Now, the most important thing is that it is the hatred against Julian Assange and the U.S. intelligence service, and the entire difference by both the Trump administration and the Biden administrations, that let this case drag on for so long. And I'm happy to say now it is settled. It is settled completely, and I believe very, very happily.
Yes, amazing. And if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and I'm speaking with Vincent DiStefano, National Organizing Director of the U.S. Assange Defense Committee. Okay, well, now tell us a little more about the negotiators on the ground. I'm always interested in lawyer strategy. So, and I know Julian has had the same lawyers for a really long time, U.S. lawyer Barry Pollack and then Australian lawyer Jennifer Robinson. What roles have they played in securing Julian's release?
Well, I can tell you right now, if anything happens to me here in the United States, the lawyer I want is Barry Pollack. Wow. And if anything happens to me in Australia, the lawyer I want is Jennifer Robinson.
Right.
A great deal of credit goes to Julian's skill and tenacity in the beginning of the trial, because he did a lot in his own defense. However, due to his increased infirmity, was the work of those two individuals, Pollack in the U.S. and Robinson in England and in Australia, negotiating with the U.S. Justice Department and the British authorities for over a year. We can, in fact, date the start of these negotiations with Julian's letter to King Charles on May 5th. Now, I don't know how the negotiations actually proceeded over the course of time, but it's likely that the U.S. started off demanding a great deal from Julian when they realized they're going to lose the case. They probably wanted him to admit to guilt for all the counts, fines for hundreds of thousands of dollars, a pledge to shut down WikiLeaks completely. However, Julian chose to hold fast, and his two lawyers, taking and debating with the U.S. team, were able to chip away at the original demands, reducing them to a shadow of what they once were. He got a helping hand, a big helping hand from political events. For most of your viewers, listeners know that the presidential election is drawing near, and so Julian's extradition and trial in the Eastern District Court of Virginia would have been a dumpster fire for the Biden administration. It could spark a war over press freedom that would divide the country and disrupt the Democratic campaign to put an enfeebled man back in office. In addition, President Biden probably felt he needed to do something to ameliorate his progressive wing. Unfortunately, this ain't going to be it. After having alienated it by supporting not only this trial against Julian and an assault on freedom of the press, but the Israeli massacre in Gaza and the never-ending war in Ukraine. He doesn't need one more thing. Additionally, the British general election was approaching, and the highly probable and now ascertained victory for Labour could give their brothers in the Australian Labour Party, staunchly pro-Assange, the chance to press the UK institutions directly to allow Julian to go free. It would torpedo their plans for vengeance against Julian. And rather than that, a plea deal, any deal would be much better. But the straw that really broke the camel's back was probably the May 20th sentence by the British magistrates, who, after years of legal hassle, finally allowed Julian to appeal against the order for extradition to the United States. Their sentence visibly shook Gordon Cromberg in the courtroom that day. He appeared dumbstruck, and his dismay redoubled when a few days later, the same judges, Sharp and Johnson, scheduled the appeal quickly rather than as had been done in the past, delay and delay and delay. In other words, instead of delaying as the past, they convened the parties almost immediately, a signal that they were seriously considering rejecting the U.S.'s request for an appeal.
Wow. And remind us who Gordon is and who the negotiators were. So in the courtroom, and then who the negotiators were, at least the department, maybe not the individuals. I don't know if you know that, but
Yes, I do.
what's
I
that?
do. Let me mention Gordon Cromberg, and this is my personal opinion and reflects no way in Assange defense. This guy is just about the worst human being on the planet next to Donald Trump. He really does not like the First Amendment, and he is a terrible, terrible lawyer who is out there promoting horrible things. But he was representing the US and the court in London, and much to his credit, he failed miserably. Now, those working on the US side, as appears in the plea document, were Sean Anderson, a US District Attorney in Guam in the Northern Marianas Islands. That was the presiding District Attorney. Matthew Olson, Assistant Attorney General for National Security, and Matthew McKenzie, Deputy Chief of Counterintelligence and Export Control of the National Security Division. Those are the three names that appear on the plea agreement. And however, I'm certain there were individuals from the Biden administration way on the down low, like Blinken and Sullivan, and perhaps even I can't imagine Biden was involved with this at all, but they were
Never
working behind
know.
the
You never know.
scenes. It appears that what they hoped to do was get this deal done as quietly and out of sight as possible, because it's embarrassing for them, because the efforts of countless activists across the country swayed this case. I want to quote something that I heard Joe Lauria say. I want to say to all the activists out there and all the alternative media, which the Lawyers Guild and Pacifica are one of, you made this happen, not our politicians, not even the British or the Australian politicians. It is the activists. Vanessa Barrister even said during the case, there's too much noise from the activists outside. Can you get them to be quiet? So regardless of what the Biden administration did, I think it was the activists that won this case. And we beat the CIA. We beat the NSA. We beat the FBI. All the forces arrayed against them. Even with this guilty plea, we beat them.
Wow. Well, yes, and that was kind of my last question, although I was going to ask also about, I think the Australian Prime Minister, I think
Oh,
Abbott
yes.
had said, but I
Anthony
wanted
Albanese spoke for the extradition to be dropped. Enough is the statement he made from Parliament and other public venues. However, considering the importance of the AUKUS deal, which is an agreement between Australia and the United States, where Australia is going to pony up more than $6 billion for a fleet of US-made subs as an agreement to participate in efforts by the administration to stand against China, I have to call Albanese's efforts to free Assange half-hearted at best. Much like the money we provide Israel that gets us nothing in return, Albanese really didn't do much of anything other than saying enough, enough. However, 75 MPs of both parties in Australia uncharacteristically came together. Like our Congress, they disagree on almost everything, and they came together to call for this extradition to be dropped, as did a smaller contingent that actually visited the United States and lobbied our Congress. Their efforts, not Albanese's, their efforts, along with the activists, made the difference.
Wow, amazing. And yeah, we are running out of time, but I wanted to give you a chance to shout out some. And of course, I want to congratulate you on your work on this because you have been, I mean, this has been, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears on your part as well. But please do talk about some of the other organizations, individuals who have fought for press freedom and fought for Julian's freedom. And I imagine he would be, I have to say, I think he would be dead if it were not for all of this support around the world. So please give a shout
A
out to
partial list
these
with
organizations.
Reporters Without Borders, Amnesty International, the ACLU, everybody except the Penn organization, which was decidedly absent on this, and activists, so many human rights organizations. And again, I wish to give a shout out to the alternative media, Kevin Gastala, Chip Gibbons, John Mearsheimer. The list is endless for the journalists who realized, unlike the mainstream media, that they were in the crosshairs on this case, and they all spoke. No drop of water is responsible by itself for the tidal wave. And I was but one drop of water with thousands of other people across the country and around the world that fought for this and fought successfully. So a shout out to all the alternative medias, all of the human rights organizations, too numerous to mention, that have fought for this. It is really an incredible moment. It is. And a special thanks to you, Maria, and in absentia to my good buddy, Jim Lafferty, for never letting this case fall too far from the public eye. And that would be the Pacifica public eye. And by the way, we're on the subject. Don't forget to contribute to this radio station if you like what you hear here.
Yes, KPFK is. It's historical. It's today. It's bringing voices out there, amplifying voices, important voices to save our democracy and civilized society. So
let me close with just two really quick things. Because,
yes, please.
And that would be that we are going to seek a pardon for Julian, but I want everybody to know a pardon is a long process and requires 5 years after the case. So the likelihood a pardon would come very quickly is a low order probability. However, doing away with the Espionage Act, that is going to be job number one for all those organizations, some of which I did not mention, but certainly for Assange defense moving forward, because that is the dagger that still sits right above the heart of freedom of the press and the public's right to dissent. And Maria, thank you very much for having me.
Yes, my pleasure. And well, one last question. Who will play you in the movie about Julian's release?
Well, I was told that I bear an uncanny resemblance to Jim Varney once by a woman at a party. So that would have to be. But unfortunately, he's dead.
Oh, no. All right. Well, you can keep thinking. Hopefully they'll give you rights to that. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here with us, Vincent DiStefano. And you are with National Organizing Director of the U.S. Assange Defense Committee, which is celebrating a humongous victory and amazing activism, amazing inspirational work that you all have done. So congratulations. And this is Maria Hall with the Lawyers Guild Show, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. And we are going to take a very short station ID break, and then we're going to be back with another segment.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman of the Bradcast, heard right here on KPFK, Mondays at 3 p.m. As you know, KPFK is corporate-free, listener-supported radio. But that means we need you to support our work and help drastically shorten our fund drives by joining the KPFK Sustainers Circle today. You can pledge $5, $10, $20, or any amount you like, automatically collected each month to help keep the Bradcast and all of the other KPFK shows on the air. Please go to kpfk.org and click Make a Pledge to join the Sustainers Circle and help keep KPFK's important, independent voices on your public airwaves. That's kpfk.org. Please sign up now. And thanks.
Okay, we're back. This is Maria Hall welcoming you back to the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. My co-host Jim Lafferty is out of town, but he'll be back in just a couple of weeks. So in the meantime, we've got another great segment for you. This is going to be about union busting and about potentially clogging up the immigration system even more than it already is, and the wonderful activists and advocates who are fighting to stop this from happening. To start us off, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, or USCIS, is a federal agency charged with handling lawful immigration to the U.S. The agency was established in 2002 to, quote, improve the efficiency and security of immigration, end quote, and it has a stated mission of upholding America's, quote, promise of fairness, integrity, and respect for all. So has the USCIS agency been living up to its stated purpose and mission? Well, as far as efficiency, as an aside, anyone who's gone through the lawful immigration system in the U.S. knows that it can take years or even decades to process these applications. So what about fairness, integrity, and respect for all? Well, I'll leave it to today's guests to comment on that, since they know the USCIS from the inside out. Today, our guests are from Local UE 1008, the union that represents skilled workers at the USCIS Service Center in Laguna Niguel. Unfortunately, union members got word that USCIS intends to shutter the facility, the only one of its kind in Southern California, and eliminating 450 jobs in the process, and those are union jobs. USCIS plans to relocate the facility in Texas and hire a non-union labor force. To explain the consequences of this decision and what union members and community organizers are doing to stop the plan from going forward, we have with us three special guests today. UE Local 1008 President Joel F. Faipon, Chief Steward Robert Holland, and union organizer Irene San Roman. A warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show to you all.
Hi there. Thank you for having us.
Sure. Hopefully all three of you are on. I can't see you, of course, because you're on the phone.
Yes, it's Irene and
Robert and Joel.
All right. Excellent. Okay, so my first question is, when and how did the workers, your union members, first learn that they'd be laid off, and what reason was given?
Okay, we were given the official word about the layoffs in January of this year. We were told it's because the biggest bulk of our work is being moved to other facilities such as Texas Service Center and these processing facilities they call lockboxes. That was about 84 people on that layoff.
And that was at the Laguna Niguel?
Yes.
Okay.
California Service Center.
Right, right. And then was that, and then there were further announcements after that?
That layoff happened in March, and we didn't get further announcements for like 2 months after that. So there's a big gap.
And then what about the most recent ones then?
Most recent, we had 111 people go June 21st, and then now we're going to have 88 go at the end of this month on the 26th. And then more to follow after that.
Oh, wow. And then what kind of, can you just tell listeners, what kind of worker do your union members do? And just how critical is this work? Talk about that, please.
So we perform the initial screening of the different types of immigrant and non-immigrant petitions and applications. And this includes examining the filings for acceptability. So the review is pretty intensive. The review that we perform is pretty intensive. And it ensures expediency to the overall processing of the forms.
And can you explain just kind of how many forms, how complicated is it? Is it just something that anyone can just walk in and do?
Oh, no. It's pretty complicated because what we do is basically federal work. When I said we do the initial screening of the petitions, we actually examine the form for acceptability and make sure that it conforms with the USCIS regulations. And it's pretty common for us to find errors from attorneys. So we were also responsible in rejecting these forms if they don't meet all the criteria.
And then what kinds of salaries and benefits have union workers there been earning?
Okay, yeah, our rates are relatively higher as a result of more than a decade of build-up through union bargaining. Compared to entry-level federal positions, we're making around $10K per year. Compared to non-union Texas Service Center and lockbox facilities. So basically, we're making an estimated amount of about $15,000 more per year.
Wow. And then what about other kinds of benefits?
We have additional PTO, paid time off, and it's way more than what the state and federal regulations provide for the type of workers that we...
And, you know, also what we'd like to share in this most recent collective bargaining agreement that was reached, right, that covers and protects workers through 2026, before the federal government decided to rip it to shreds as of January of this year. We sat through several rounds of bargaining, right? And we hear this narrative time and again about doing things the right way, whether it's seeking asylum or going about organizing your union, right? Do it the right way, follow the rules. And we know that rules and the laws usually aren't written to protect the working class. So we can follow the rules and do things the right way as best as we can, from organizing and securing this contract agreement through 2026. They tried to come for layoff language protection that we had. They tried to come for seniority protections that we won, and they came for wages as well as so many other things that we secured in a very strong contract. Why? You know, did the ink even dry after we sat so many rounds in bargaining, negotiating fairly, round after round, arguing for words, right? And why would the government mislead 400-plus working-class families, not just the workers themselves, but the entire families who went through this collective bargaining process? And were lied to, because if they didn't get it their way, they would find a way to secure cheap labor elsewhere and remove our jobs and bust our union. Why are they coming for California first? Because we're the strongest, and they'd love to make an example out of us. Our union, Local 1008, went out to help our sister locals in Nebraska and Vermont, where this is surely to hit them next, right? And they are smaller locals, but they are ready to fight back.
Wow. So explain that a little bit more, too. So you'd actually been involved in negotiating for more worker protection. You'd been successful. And then right after that, suddenly they announced that, oh, we're going to shutter you anyway?
That's right. That's when, within a year, the rug got swept out from underneath us, and the similarities that we're noticing, you know, even with violence against women petitions, where now the applications are free and available to everyone online, or so they say, they are reducing the number of pairs of eyes that will be reviewing those petitions. It's like help is on the way, and before the words even come out of their mouths, they have found a way to take it away.
Wow. And like I had mentioned from their website, how it talks about, oh, it was founded for to promote efficiency and to help people who are actually trying to become legal citizens or other, you know, be here in a lawful way, like people who are victims of violence, the Violence Against Women Act. So that does kind of, how does that also, how does that line up with how they're now treating the workers?
So the overall effect of the downsizing is pretty much it will delay the process. So in our minds, this is a great disservice for those people who are seeking to get immigration benefits and protection from being legal residents of this country.
Right. Well, talk a little bit more about your union.
In terms of how it's impacting workers here, I mean, it's spanning the gamut, right? Because we know that the federal government, when they came for seniority language and layoff protections, we knew that we needed to protect the most vulnerable in our bargaining unit, right? Our seniors that are ready to retire, some of whom have dedicated more than a decade, some who've dedicated more than 20 years to this agency and are being let go unceremoniously without the proper, right way of being able to retire, if you will. The federal government knows that some of these folks who are employed here who have disabilities will be discriminated against as well, right? Won a collective bargaining agreement, and the federal government says, no, get in line for unemployment instead.
Wow.
They are compounding the crisis at the border. What it means for workers inside here, as we are at the Chet Holyfield Federal Building in Laguna Niguel doing this interview today, it's almost a ghost town where we are. But that doesn't mean that the facility is closing down. It does mean that for folks, they are being reminded by management to not speak to the press and to not share the stories about what's happening.
Oh, wow. Who is telling workers that? It's the bosses?
Management.
Management,
USCIS.
Also, in line with what Irene mentioned about the crisis at the border, we also work on asylum cases. The form type is called I-539. Where the applicants actually exist outside the economy. So it would mean a burden for the taxpayers who would have to subsidize the support for these folks. So it's in the best interest of everyone for the USCIS to process asylum applications expeditiously so that applicants could be given work permits and contribute to the economy. I mean, that's what they're here for, to seek a better life for themselves and be productive members of the society. Because of the downsizing, it actually affects the processing time for these cases.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then meanwhile, people are stuck and they can't contribute, right? They can't get a job and so forth.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little more about the union? I'm embarrassed to admit I hadn't heard of it before, the local UE. Or the UE. Can one of you tell us about that? And I apologize that I'm not calling on an individual. I'm just kind of letting you choose who to talk about. Maybe start with Joel.
Yes. So our local was chartered in 2008. And I have been the president since then.
And what is the theme of your union? What kind of support does it provide and who can join the union?
Okay, so UE is actually a rank and file union. That means we govern ourselves. We have our own set of officers in the workplace. We are not an outside group that deals with the problems in the workplace. We deal with our own problems ourselves. So, over the course of more than a decade, we were able to build strong job protections and added benefits for our members. We get more paid time off than what's granted by both the federal and state regulations. We also have health and welfare entitlement that's relatively higher than the federal regulations provide, among many different benefits.
The reason why you may not have heard of us before, first of all, UE has a long history since, 1930s. In the U.S. labor movement. We are no longer affiliated with the American Federation of Labor or the CIO, which is what it was back then, and disaffiliated from the CIO, around the McCarthyism era. So UE really is the union for everybody, right? It's not just the electrical and radio and machine workers union. We bring on everybody. Why is McCarthyism and the history of the labor movement important? Well, the ASL at one point asked folks to sign affidavits so that they could verify that whether it was members or organizers, that they were not affiliated with socialism or the Communist Party in the U.S. It was a way of declawing, defanging, and de-radicalizing the rank and file, mostly immigrant-led labor movement that fought for and won the 8-hour workday. This is a labor movement that largely belongs to immigrant anarchists. UE doesn't care what your religion or faith tradition is or, any of that. You are welcome in our union, and we are not going to collaborate with the government to let them know that you are ready to be their lapdog.
Wow, amazing. If you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and I've been speaking with union representatives from UE Local 10:08, President Joel F. Faipon, Chief Steward Robert Holland, and organizer Irene San Roman about the U.S. government's plan to shutter USCIS Service Center, which is now in Laguna, lay off the 450 union members working at the current facility, and go to Texas to hire non-union labor. So tell us then, we have about, I want to save time for, I know I prepared way too many questions, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about what will losing their jobs mean for the families who rely on this income, because a union job is, that's hard to come by, and the cost of living in Southern California is really high. So can one or more than one of you please talk about that?
Well, we've heard from a couple of our members that they could face eviction. That's one. Mm. We do have a good number of members who are under retirement age, and they're still talking about their struggles with rent and are considering getting roommates or any type of remedy that they could think of. Mm-hmm. Some of our members, especially the elder, they also rely on this job for health benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's not just pure economic impact. It's more of like the way of living would change because of the downsides.
Mm-hmm. For a lot of the folks, like I said earlier, who are older and closer to retirement age, for folks who have, secured protections through their unions, whether it's for reasonable accommodations for a disability or anything like that, they will face a lot of discrimination when they try to re-enter the workforce. We know that there is ageism. We know that there is discrimination against folks with disabilities, and it's just very tragic. Again, like we said, we just secured an agreement protecting these folks through 2026 that was won the right way. Why would the federal government then decide to shred that agreement and have folks instead line up for unemployment?
Mm. Well, also, as a follow-up, what would be the impact of, say on the bigger picture for USCIS? I would imagine they're saying, oh, it's going to be more efficient to move to Texas and hire labor force. How do you think this will impact the efficiency of the system and the cost?
Well, I'm not sure about the cost, but the efficiency itself, that is arguable. So when they're moving the work to Texas, there's actually weather problems in Texas. And a month ago, we actually received boxes of files that are soaking wet.
Oh.
And we had to dry them on tables here. That's what we were doing for a couple of days. So I don't think that whoever came up with this experiment, and I refer to this as an experiment, they didn't think it through. Mm-hmm. Right? They have not included some factors, like in this case, the weather. Also, the Texas Service Center has a high, their workers don't last over there. They quit because of the pay is too low.
Mm-hmm.
And poor labor conditions because they're not union.
Mm-hmm. Right. And how do you think this will... Go ahead.
I was just going to say the center. It's a nice area. I grew up actually in Texas, so I know where it is. And the weather's definitely a factor. Doesn't normally flood there, because it's not near the coast, but that definitely affects getting the work done. And the reason why we sent work to them, and they sent it right back to us.
Wow! Because of the weather. Okay.
Yeah. So, the building flooded recently, so they closed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, and I would love to hear from Irene also on that and sort of the broader impact and the irony, or maybe not irony, maybe we should expect it more, that, the way that the government is running these kinds of humongous agencies. Anytime you move, that's not going to be very efficient. But I would love to hear Irene's thoughts on this as well.
Absolutely. The inefficiency runs amok here. And one of the main ways that we can highlight it is the way that, you know, the boss will try to pit worker against each other. You will have the federal government telling folks in Nebraska and Vermont, don't worry about layoffs, yet, because all of the work from California and any backlogs in Texas, y'all are the cleanup kids, and you're so efficient, and you're going to get more work as a result over here. See, it's a pattern of working people to the point of extracting them to the point of not being able to extract anything left, right, for their labor. And it's just really sad. But the rank and file members of UE are smart. They recognize the patterns. They recognize what has happened in California is very similar to the messages that they are now hearing in Nebraska service centers and in Vermont as well. And they are preparing to fight. One of our first actions was a coordinated action between California and Nebraska. They received a lot of attention out there, and I know that we have also heard from the office of Senator Bernie Sanders, who has pledged support and to work on this issue, because when there is an injury to one, it is an injury to all. We know that the federal government is very sneaky. They will lie to the media, and they will lie to their own workers and employees, no matter, you know, what the situation, whether it's good faith bargaining and them showing up and lying to us through omission. If they had told us at the negotiations table a year ago, you know, stop fighting for protections through 2026, your contract will cease to exist within 6 months, they would have negotiated for something very different for these members.
Yeah, severance or something.
They did not do that. They did not say that. They said, you know, there might be layoffs, but not to the degree of total elimination of a workforce in Orange County, a vital workforce at that. Mm-hmm. Just today at our rally in front of the federal facility, we had a prospective candidate for Irvine City Council in the first district who is connected with immigration associations of lawyers called AILA. And she was brought to tears. She came of her own volition. She had just heard word of mouth about what was happening here and understands the connection as a former immigration rights attorney herself, what importance and significance these roles and these jobs hold, that her role and her job cannot function without these critical roles. And, you know, it wasn't long ago that so many of these 450 folks of UE Local 1008 were told at the peak of the COVID crisis that they were forced to return to work into this very building that now sits vacant. Because they were essential workers, because they were heroes, because the crisis at the border was only compounding. And at this juncture, just tragic. Lies upon lies upon lies.
Wow. Well, this has to be exposed. And we have only 1 minute left. So I do want to follow up with you all again on a future episode. But last question, can the decision be changed, or is there other legal recourse or other community resources? And what can listeners do to help this cause?
Sure. All it would take is a stroke of a pen from those who are authorized to make decisions. Mm. So we find ourselves having no other recourse but to put pressure on the USCIS to reconsider their decision through community support. So, so we were given a heads up. As Irene mentioned, that the reduction in force will happen, it was not supposed to be at this magnitude and speed.
Mm-hmm. And Irene, did you want to add about the rallies?
Yeah, so we will be rallying every week on Wednesday at 11 a.m. to about 3 p.m. out here in Laguna Niguel at the Chet Holyfield Federal Facility. We are so looking forward to any community support that is out there. I do believe we will be rolling out a complaint website for community members who may be stuck in this process and have been waiting, you know, sometimes 10 years, sometimes up to 15 years to have their cases reviewed and adjudicated. So we would love to hear from you about, you know, what this means for your family. But the best way to keep in touch with us, of course, follow us on social media, on Facebook and on Instagram at UE Union. On Facebook, look for us as UE Local 1008. And we will be posting updates on there as well as community letters of support and petitions for folks to stay abreast of the situation. The last of the layoffs happened in September, and we will be going until it is over.
All right. Thank you so much. We have to wrap up, but that was Joel Faipon, Robert Holland, and organizer Irene San Roman. And I'm Maria Hall from the Lawyers Guild Show. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Stand up for your right.